This is a public announcement. The Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins Burke will begin shortly. Thank you.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from Nottingham. This is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins Burke on Teachers Talk Radio.
Hey up, me duck, it's Saturday, it's 1 p.m. and this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins Burke. In the next 90 minutes, we'll be talking about improving students' writing and knowing when it's time to move school. This is your show, so give me your views, listen in, text in and call in to share your thoughts on the show. Tune in, talk it out, live on Podbean. This is Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Nottingham, this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins Burke on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
We are live and we are ready to go. Can somebody in the studio please tell me whether or not you can hear me? Welcome to the Saturday Lunch on Teachers Talk Radio. My name is Tom Hopkins Burke and I still have 3 more days at work until the summer holidays. Thanks, Tim. That's right, you might have broken up for the summer holidays yourself, but I teach in Nottinghamshire, so I am still going until the 28th of July. Still, mustn't grumble. Over the course of the next 90 minutes, I'll be talking about how we can improve our students' writing using strategies from the writing revolution at a primary and secondary level, and also when we know it's time to move schools, and why teachers don't move schools, even though they don't like it there. I have a couple of cracking guests lined up, so it promises to be a great show. Last week, I spoke about school values. I quoted Mary Myatt, and I explored how we could live not merely laminate our values and embed them across the whole school community. I asked how schools cultivate their values and promote them and how they know they are being lived. I was also joined by one of my history teaching colleagues, Kelly Seeley, who talked about mentoring trainee teachers. How do you build that supportive relationship? How do you teach them to walk before they can run? What do you do if it goes wrong? I discussed those questions and many more with Kelly. So if you're listening to this show, once you've finished with me today, why not catch up afterwards? It was a great show. I really enjoyed it and I hope you did too. On today's show, I'm talking about improving students' writing in primary and secondary schools. I'm joined by Joe Kinnaird and George Knapfeen to talk about how they have used the writing revolution in their classrooms. In the second half of the show, I'll be asking, why do teachers move schools? I'd love to hear from you and your experiences, so call and text in to tell me why you have moved schools. You can share your thoughts on the show live using the Podbean app. The Saturday Lunch is live every Saturday between 1 and 2:30 p.m. and you can text in your views or call in to make your voice heard by clicking on one of the call-in icons. We are live streaming our shows via Twitter, Facebook and YouTube. If you are listening via Twitter, Facebook or YouTube, then a very good afternoon to you. And of course, if you're listening back via our website, ttradio.org/listenback, via Podbean, via Spotify or via Apple Podcasts, then a warm welcome to you today. If you want to interact directly with myself and with today's guests, then download the Podbean app, subscribe to Teachers Talk Radio and get calling in and texting in. Please also tweet us at TTRadio2021 with the hashtag TTRadio with your thoughts on the show, whether you're listening live or listening back. This is, of course, Talk Radio and I want to hear from you. So if you've moved schools recently or if you've stayed put and you're regretting it or you are very happy with where you are, it is your show. So when I move on to that segment from 2 p.m, do call in with your thoughts. And if you can't wait until 2 p.m, text in with your thoughts now and I will read them out when we get to 2 p.m. To call in, you need to press one of those call-in icons or the phone icon down the bottom of your screen. You need to bring your headphones and get ready to tune in and talk it out. In the meantime, it's time for the latest education news with the return of Jo Fox. Great to have Jo back. I deputised for her last weekend, but it is time now to leave the news to the pros. As ever, call in, text in with your thoughts on the news.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports in the Manchester Evening News, hundreds of students attending high schools across Bolton are set to take part in catch-up sessions over the summer break. Many schools across the borough have taken up the Department for Education's offer of funding for summer schools following disruption due to the pandemic. Following advice from government, many of the schools are focusing on Year 7 as many primary schools have been unable to manage the usual transition process. It is expected that the majority of the sessions will be devoted to students due to start high school in September and will focus on building relationships with staff and getting to know the buildings and facilities. 21 schools across Bolton are holding summer schools, which equates to 73% of all eligible mainstream secondaries in the area. The funding comes from a £200 million pot, which was announced in February by the Department for Education. Primary school has won a landmark case in the High Court. Yew Tree Primary School in Sandwell has succeeded in preventing the Department for Education forcing it to become an academy after Ofsted graded it inadequate. In a judgment on Friday the 23rd of July, Gavin Mansfield QC said he had grave concern about the decision to transform it into an academy. As reported by ITV News Online, the judge said there was clear evidence of both continued efforts to improve and success in achieving those improvements. The judge therefore concluded that the decision to force academisation was irrational. The court's decision does not overturn the academy order, but it does force the Education Secretary to consider the decision again and to take additional evidence into account. In January 2019, an academy order was issued following the inadequate judgment, but when a subsequent inspection took place 9 months later, the school was removed from the category of serious weakness. A Department for Education spokesman said it was now considering its next steps in relation to Yew Tree Primary. The BBC News website reports that English language schools are facing a second summer of empty classrooms due to the pandemic. Most schools receive pupils from all over the world during the summer, but English UK, who represent a sector worth around £1.4 billion a year, is on the verge of collapse. Language schools feel their plight has been overlooked during the pandemic. The Anglo-Lang School in Scarborough would normally welcome around 2,500 students each year, but for the last two summers, classrooms have been deserted. A group of 36 MPs have written to Boris Johnson calling for support for the language teaching sector, as the pandemic puts 35,000 jobs at risk and the loss of the £1.4 billion brought to local economies as students study, live and entertain themselves in local areas.
Live from Nottingham, this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio. It's 1:09 PM and that was the weekend news with Jo Fox. I want to hear from you today. How have you tried to improve your students' writing in your classroom? When is the right time to move schools? When is it right to stay put? Call and text in with your thoughts. Tune in and talk it out live on Podbean. This is Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Nottingham, this is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Thank you to Joe Fox for Weekend News. Thank you to Amy Ferguson for sharing the show. Thank you to Nikki McGee, who has tweeted, improving our students' writing skills in RE is a big focus for me this year, so I'm tuning in to listen with Joe Kinnaird and George Napfine. Thank you for the news again, Joe. Is your school running a summer school? How much interest have you had from your students? Or how about interest from your teachers to run the sessions? Which students are you targeting? Do you teach in Bolton or Greater Manchester? I'd love to hear from you. Call and text in with your views. I'm now absolutely delighted to be joined by Joe Kinnaird. Joe is head of Key Stage 3 RE and has blogged about all things RE philosophy and curriculum at mrkinnairdre.wordpress.com. He's also blogged about how he's used techniques from the writing revolution and they say, I say, the moves that matter in academic writing. These are books which I've used this year as well in my own practice as a history teacher, the former, typically with Key Stage 3 and 4, and the latter with Key Stage 5. Our focus today is going to be on the writing revolution, but anything which Jay wants to add about They Say, I Say is hugely valuable too. Welcome, Joe. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. I'm not too bad, thank you. First day of the summer holidays, and I hope you get to the summer holidays very quickly.
George and I both teach in Nottinghamshire, so we both finish on Wednesday. George has an inset day last day, but I'm teaching until the bitter end. Thank you very much, and I hope you are enjoying the start of your holidays.
Thank you.
In your experience as an RE teacher, why do students struggle with writing?
I think there's a lot of reasons. I think more generally, not just in RE, but I don't think we teach the explicit skills of how to write. And I feel that a lot of the time, from my own experience, I've just assumed by like some magical occurrence that they'll know how to write, and that's often not the case. And I think they struggle how to write because we often don't break down the most fundamental basics of how to write effectively. I also think that students struggle with it because often it can sound quite daunting, especially when they're especially like the sort of language that we use to phrase it, like you're going to write an essay or you're going to produce an extended piece of writing. And I think by breaking down those key steps and having time to practice those key steps, we can sort of overcome those struggles that they have. So I think there's a range of reasons why they struggle.
Thanks very much, Matt. And certainly I share your view about perhaps focusing on the bigger picture too quickly. So when did you first come across the writing revolution?
It would have been probably about a couple of years ago. My brilliant colleague, Daniel Hugel, at my school was reading the book, and I soon picked up a copy and was reading it then. But like with most things in schools, it is very hard to have that dedicated time to focus on skills that you want to implement. So I then came back to it probably just over a year ago. And I think the interest peaked. I was seeing a lot of teachers on Twitter, especially in the history community, speak about the writing revolution. And I thought it would be good to go back to it, especially given the nature of last year where we were working from home and had a little bit more time to sort of focus on things that I wouldn't get to focus on whilst being a full-time class teacher. So I came across it about 2 years ago, I'd say.
Okay, yeah, brilliant. I came across it I came across it a couple of years ago, same time as you. I only really started picking it up and reading it intensely about a year ago. I was very fortunate in which this year in which I had a trainee who was teaching a couple of my year 7 classes and one of my year 9 classes, and we worked together very closely to think about how we could implement some of the strategies and the work as well. So but if you don't have that time, if you're teaching 22 out of 25, then you know it's very difficult. So what were your first, go on, were you going to add something?
I think it is very difficult, and I think one of the things that helped me coming back to it was seeing that there's a lot of people sort of reading it. And I think there's this sort of, I think that in the last couple of years there's been a huge focus on curriculum and the sort of what do we want students to know. And I think that whilst those questions are really important, I think it's also important to consider how is that reflected in student writing? Because if they can't write about it, I'm not sure how well they know it. And we have a big push on an ambitious curriculum, but I think we have to spend an equal amount of time thinking about how we're going to reflect that in the student writing, that they learn about these beautiful ideas in our subjects, in history, in RE, in English, and so on. And we want that they are able to write beautifully about that. And I think one thing that I was really keen to move away from was the P paragraph. And I just think, I don't think any of us got into teaching to teach about, you know, the design argument or the, you know, the causes of the Vietnam War and reduce student writing to a P paragraph. So I wanted to move away from that. And I think the writing revolution was the breakthrough in terms of how to move away from that.
Definitely. And this point about giving students the opportunity to demonstrate what they know, I think is really, really important. Yeah. I found this year, for the first time, I've been teaching the Tudor Rebellions at A level in history, and it's Unit 3 of OCR. And anybody who teaches Unit 3 of OCR in A level history will know that the essay writing involves synthesis. So it involves, comparing rebellions continuously. So giving students the language, I call it the four C's, and I can never remember what they stand for. It's like comparison, concession, conclusion, and there's another one as well, maybe what be contrast. But giving students the language through they say I say in particular, to give them the tools by which they can show what they know and show their skills of comparison and their knowledge of the different rebellions, just books like The Writing Revolution and They Say, I Say, just give students the opportunity, the tools to demonstrate what they know. So when you came across the first Writing Revolution and you started to delve into it, what were your first impressions?
Well, if I'm being brutally honest, I felt overwhelmed. I read it and I found it quite daunting because there was lots of vocabulary that I'd not come across before, like appositives and subordinating conjunctions I will have learnt when I was in school, but I mean, they're not terms that I would use in everyday conversation in the classroom. So I found it initially a little bit daunting and overwhelming. And the first read that I had through it, I was like, I'm just going to have to start everything from scratch, or how do I build this into a scheme of work, or how do I embed this across Key Stage 3? So my initial thoughts were, I was a little bit overwhelmed by it, if I'm being honest.
I remember feeling very similar. I remember reading it and thinking, oh wow, but just wow, there's a lot we need to do here, and there's a lot which our students are struggling with, and there's a lot which we need to do. And certainly I remember reading, I think it was Josh Valance, who did an excellent blog post about how actually he embedded the Writing Revolution almost as a progression model throughout Key Stage 3 in history, which really transformed how I thought about it. But it's one of those books, isn't it? I mean, one of the other ones is Oliver Cavaglioli, Dual Coding for Teachers, and it's not a book which I think is intended to be read cover to cover. It's one which I think, you know, you sort of delve in bit by bit, and you and you find strategies, you read individual chapters at a time, and you think, how can you reflect, and you think, how can I embed this into my own practice? I know there were some English teachers in the studio at the moment, and certainly from an English perspective, it'd be very interesting to hear, have you come across with Writing Revolution, or what other books have you used to help give students the tools to succeed with their writing? So you've got your first impressions, Jay, which is, this is overwhelming, but it's good. Yes. How did you, what were your first steps then in terms of incorporating the Writing Revolution strategies into your own practice?
The first step, it sounds a bit of a shock, but I think the first step is to actually read it without thinking about my subject. Reading, sounds awful, but read it without thinking about blogs that other people have done or how they've implemented it into their subject. I think the best thing is to actually just focus on the technique itself, and look at, well, what is this technique? How is this technique helping students to write? And then, I mean, in terms of the way the book's set out, it talks about the reasoning behind the strategy. It then gives some examples of the strategy. So my thoughts were to read the strategy, understand its aims and its outcomes. And then what I tried to do with each strategy was to think about, well, what might this look like within an RE context, or what might this look like in a year eight lesson on the history of Islam? So I started to think with each strategy about, okay, what might it look like? And then I ignored my fears about I'm going to have to start from scratch with this. And what I essentially did was I just dropped the odd strategy into a lesson. So it might have been a do now activity at the start of the lesson where I gave students three sentence stems with because but so, mm-hmm. and got them to complete the sentences. Or it might be that I gave students three sentences and I got them to add in an appositive to each sentence to tell more information about the noun of the sentence. So my thinking was to just drop the odd strategy in. And one of the key cornerstones of the book was to focus, to start with sentences, because sentences are the building blocks of writing. And I thought I have to take that principle when it comes to incorporating the writing revolution into my practice. So I started with sentence level strategies, and then eventually I looked to build in paragraph level strategies, and eventually longer pieces of writing, essay writing level strategies into schemes of learning within, well, key stage 3 to 5, really.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. We've got a text in from Nikki McGee, part of the RE crew and one of my former guests. Nikki says, this is so helpful. I've never really moved beyond the feeling overwhelmed stage by the writing revolution. I've used bits mainly suggested by Joe rather than the book. So, yeah, good to see, Joe, that your work and your blog posts have had an impact on the wider RE community. And I think, actually, what I would say, Nikki, is exactly what Joe said, which is actually it's only until you start reading the book and just putting everything else sort of on the back burners and just focusing on the book when you can think really, really clearly. And, you know, I got loads of ideas. I mean, from the history teaching community, I think Christian Shanks, one of the biggest writers on this, he was on with Ebony Fowler Rancher on Monday, and also Rachel Ball and there are other people. And I remember reading their blog post and I'm thinking, oh, this is really good stuff. I love how they've incorporated this. Greg Thornton as well.
Greg's great.
Greg used to go... Greg was a pupil at the school where I now teach, wow. Which is astonishing. But yeah, and so yeah, I mean, Greg's blog posts are just really, really helpful. And I remember looking at his scheme of work on the Industrial Revolution and looking at how he'd used the kernel sentences, for example, and because, but, and so to suggest, well, is it a Liberty's Dawn? Well, it's a Liberty's Dawn because. It's a Liberty's Dawn, but it's not a Liberty's Dawn for everybody. And so what does that mean in practice? So I think, you know, I think reading those within my own subject community has really, really helped me think about actually not just how do we improve students' writing, but how do we improve students' writing in our own subject, which is a question I'm going to come on to when I talk about some, not criticisms, but some of the questions about the writing revolution. Where am I now? I suppose I better move on to my next question. What has the writing revolution enabled your students to do, which they've struggled to do before?
Well, I think coming back to the first question, it's sort of removed the sense of dread or daunting fear that students may have before taking on an extended writing task. I think as well, by starting at the basics with the sentence and seeing improvements there, it gives students confidence to go further when we look at a paragraph or when we look at an extended piece of writing. So I think it's helped boost their general confidence in writing. I think specifically with writing itself, I think it's allowed them to understand the purposes of different types of sentences and the purpose of different types of conjunctions we'd use in a sentence. It's enabled them to use more complex sentences, boost their vocabulary, and sort of linking in with the curriculum discussion that we had a little bit earlier on, I think it encourages closer reading of the text. You know, I think in both our subjects, history and RE, students are reading a lot in each lesson. And I think when the reading is used to supplement the writing, it encourages students to read the text even more closely than if we just gave a quite an open-ended question for students to write about. I think when it's something specific and the strategy is driven by specific knowledge, then I think students can see greater confidence in the writing they produce.
Definitely, definitely. I think about some of the year sevens I teach, and you know, writing is it's such a confidence. It's driven by confidence more than just about anything else, I think, yeah. Which we do, certainly in a history classroom. And if students don't have that confidence, then actually that can sort of stop them before they even begin. One of those infamous sort of questions is, but how do I start? And, the writing revolution does help with that. You've mentioned because, but so, you've mentioned the positives, yeah. I've mentioned kernel sentences. Which strategies from the writing revolution in particular have you found most helpful in your own practice and why?
Well, I think because but so is the most famous, and you know it's there's something so heartening about using it and seeing what students come out with, and using that strategy across the key stages. Students come out with some fantastic sentences, and I never would have thought as a teacher that I would jump for joy at a beautiful sentence, but reading the Writing Revolution has certainly enabled that. I also think that going from the sentence to the paragraph level, I can't remember where I read this, but I saw someone write something recently, and they said, if you look after the words, then the sentences take care of themselves. Look after the sentences, the paragraphs take care of themselves, and look after the paragraphs, and the essay takes care of themselves. And I found that taking that sort of building block approach has been really beneficial, I think. Going to the paragraph level, I've found useful in terms of planning a paragraph. So formulating a topic sentence, how to provide supporting details, and how to form an effective closing sentence. Mm-hmm. I've found that useful. And then modeling that strategy at a multi-paragraph level for a multi-paragraph outline has been helpful. Also, formulating general, specific, and thesis statements I find quite useful at A level. And I think as well, like a sort of another underlying principle in the book that I found helpful is this idea that writing is never finished. The idea that we are constantly looking to review our work and make improvements to it. I saw a picture, I can't remember where it was shared, but it was a picture of a speech from Barack Obama he was giving, and he had the speech typed out, but there were so many crosses out and circles and things. And I showed it to the students to say, you know, look, all writers constantly review and update.
Mm.
And I like that, how the writing revolution encourages that. So much that I found useful from the book.
Fantastic. So I mentioned earlier that there are some sort of, there are people like, for example, Christine Council and Jim mm-hmm. Carroll in history who urge caution with the writing revolution, who argue that maybe it doesn't help students with writing techniques situated within particular subject domains. And Jim Carroll's argument in particular is that you can't teach the language of, say, causation or significance using the writing revolution alone. It's not a solution to the problems of writing well within a particular subject area. I was wondering what you made of that argument.
I remember reading that piece and some of the things Christine Council said, and I think they're right to say that. I think this is a worry with many things in teaching and learning, that we see an idea shared and we just go for it and implement it without having thought about it or even having read the original source. And I think that with anything that we are looking to bring into the classroom, it requires careful thinking from subject specialists. And subject specialists are ultimately the best people placed to think about how a strategy or an idea could be implemented within the classroom and the curriculum. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all approach, where I don't think every teacher should be going into the classroom and using writing revolution strategies every single lesson. I don't think that's right. And I don't think we should ever be prescriptive like that. I think it's about reading things such as the Writing Revolution, reading books such as They Say, I Say. And I think using them and thinking about them from a subject specialist perspective and thinking, how does this sit alongside disciplinary knowledge? How does this sit alongside the substantive knowledge that we want students to acquire in the classroom? And I think it's, I think with the things that Christine Council and Jim Carroll were saying, I think they're right to point out that these things are far more complex than we want to allow. But at the same time, I think it's important that we have strategies that enable students to build confidence in the basics of writing. And then as that confidence progresses, we can then look to develop the necessary skills to really flourish within each subject domain.
Definitely. And I think your last point there, it charms me with something which Christian Shank said, which is that, you know, for all of the fantastic which primary school teachers do, and I'm going to be talking about this with George, there are students who turn up in year seven lacking some of the most basic reading and writing skills. And that's through no fault of primary teachers at all. And there are a multitude of reasons why. And giving them those most basic tools, even if you're thinking sort of subject, verb, object, that sort of most basic sentence level stuff, you can't move into some of them, into creating sophisticated causal arguments or, establishing the criteria of significance if you don't have the most basic, generic, building blocks in the first place, I think. Yeah. I'm not sure if there's anything you wanted to add to that, Joe.
No, and I also think, I was reflecting on this because I've got a year seven form next year. And I was thinking that the incoming year sevens have not had a traditional school year since year four. And, they're going to come into secondary school and we don't really know what September may look like. And I think actually, yes, we want high challenge, we want rigor, but I also want that we can master the basics first and breed that confidence so that when we look at the more complex things, when we look at the more challenging things, students are looking at the challenge with that foundation of confidence in the basics.
Definitely. One final question. What would you, if there'll be teachers who are listening to this live or on demand who are thinking of using Writing Revolution strategies in their classroom, what advice would you give to them?
I think the advice I'd give to them is to read the book without reading any of the blogs or articles. First, I think just read the book, look at the strategy, and then start to think about two or three possible ways they could look to translate that strategy into the classroom. And then I would just try one strategy, 5 minutes at a lesson, focused on one strategy. And when you see the results, it will encourage you to go again. I think it's a really groundbreaking book, but I think it's really important to go slow with it get a real grip of what the strategy is asking of students and what it can produce, and then drop one into a lesson, see the results. And I think that will not only give the encouragement to the students to approach writing with more confidence, but also provide the teacher with the confidence that actually they can deliver explicit writing instruction as well.
Fantastic. Writing really is a confidence game. Thanks for coming on, Joe. It's been really useful to hear about how you've been adopting Writing Revolution strategies in your RE secondary classroom. Thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Tom.
No, take care. We're now going to take a short ad break. But when we come back, I'm going to be asking questions about the Writing Revolution to our next guest, who is George Napthine, who's going to be talking about the Writing Revolution from a primary school perspective. My guests usually have a secondary bias, so I am very keen to hear from a primary voice this afternoon. Join us after a break.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.cre8tiveresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club. Introducing the Leadership Masterclass Series by Diana Osagie. Learn how to ditch your fears and develop your leadership confidence. How to deal with difficult colleagues. How to thrive when you lead in a challenging environment. And how to get colleagues to buy into your vision. Join Diana for her online leadership masterclasses, starting on the 10th of July and running all the way through the summer. These sessions are the perfect way to prepare and refresh for the next academic year and beyond. Book your place at courageousleadership.co.uk/events. Now, the first 50 leaders to sign up get an additional free mini coaching session with Diana herself. Don't miss this. Courageous Leadership Masterclasses at courageousleadership.co.uk/events.
Welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio. This is the Saturday Lunch with Tom Hopkins Burke. It's 1:38 p.m. and I'm now delighted to be joined by George Napfin, who's going to be talking about improving students' writing using techniques from the writing revolution, this time from a primary perspective. In case you weren't listening earlier, George teaches in Nottingham. He's still got 3 days left at work. Unlike myself, he's got an inset on the 28th, that final day, whereas I am teaching until the bitter, bitter end. Welcome to the show, George. Almost there now. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Surviving, I think, is the word which I'd use at the moment in this time of the year. It's been a very, very long half term. So you teach in Nottingham in a primary school, not very far away from where I live, actually, about 10 minutes down the road. In your experience, then, as a primary teacher, why do students struggle with writing?
Well, I suppose it's probably for the same reasons as secondary school children struggle, but there's the obvious reasons that, you know, it might be their second language. You know, we'll have children arriving who speak no English. I think also it's worth bearing in mind that writing itself is such a hard thing to do. I think we're surrounded by kind of quite bad writing all the time that adults are guilty of. It's also something where if you love reading and you become familiar with what you think of as really good writing, becomes something you kind of sense You read something and think, oh, that's well written. But actually breaking it down and defining why it's well written is a whole different thing, especially in primary, probably, because you really have to break it down a lot. It, within a class, you know, within every classroom, there's such a massive range of ability. So on the one end, you've got, you know, people who might have special educational needs or they don't speak much English. But at the other end as well, I think people struggle with writing because you get this kind of hideous primary school writing style where children have kind of crowbarred in as many long adjectives and semicolons as they can. And it becomes quite unpleasant to read. But some people would say, oh, look at that. That's really good because, you know, they've used a semicolon. The adverbs are fantastic. But you just think, if you read this in a book, you'd just think, what is this?
Yeah.
So I think it's a really difficult one, whichever angle you're coming from. But overall, I think it's helpful to just think that clarity is like the thing we're after. Whether you're writing a horror story or a piece of history, you want to be clear and paint a clear picture in the person's, the reader's mind. And I think the writing revolution helps with that.
Some really useful thoughts there, and it's not limited to primary. The feedback I got on my writing in year 8 and in year 9 for a good 2 years was use more semicolons. So it's not limited to primary. Yeah. When did you first come across the writing revolution, Ben?
It was only a few months ago, really. My story is quite a familiar one. I only joined Twitter a few months ago as well, really. And I so often read that people have gone through this same thing. So when I trained, which was 8 or 9 years ago, it was very much, you know, discovery, learning, don't talk too much and that kind of thing. And then I only recently just started reading a lot of books about teaching. And obviously every old idea and every new idea about teaching is completely surrounded by cynicism from every quarter almost. So, but I found it kind of reignited my love of the job because it just made me start to think about all the different things I'm doing. And so I'd heard people talk about the writing revolution. And it was just not one of the books I'd got around to getting. And then a few months ago, I think David Dido or someone had mentioned it in one of his books or on a blog post or something. And I think Joe said the same thing. You just hear a lot of people talking about the same thing. And think, oh, well, I have to get around to that eventually. And then I did.
Great. And what were your first impressions of the writing revolution then?
Well, it was interesting that Joe said he was really overwhelmed because maybe it's just because I'm so used to being out of my depth. But I actually thought, oh, this is quite practical because it kind of told the story of how they developed the scheme, which interestingly was specifically to help with special educational needs, I believe, at first. And then it kind of got rolled out to mainstream education. But I just thought, and I hadn't finished the book by the time I started implementing things. We were just about to start a unit on Treasure Island, which I won't be doing again in year 5 for the record because it does get pretty hard. But I just thought, oh, and that because but so was like the first exercise in there. And I thought, oh, I'll just try that out. So I just kind of did, you know, Jim worked in the Admiral Benbow and little sentences like that. And I said, right, I just want you to write that sentence, but then try and extend it. And it worked so well as just a standalone lesson. And kind of, unscramble a scrambled sentence and just each one I just put straight in. And I think probably, I mean, it's not true of all schools, but in my school, I do have a good amount of autonomy and I can just kind of think, right, I'll try that out tomorrow and I'll try that in next week. I'll do this. And it just worked so well and it felt so clear. And I felt like, especially those children who did have English as a second language and, you know, would really struggle with those kind of assumptions of, you know, I'll write a paragraph about this, you know, that kind of thing that isn't helpful when you don't really know how to write a sentence. I thought that it was just so useful that I just kind of implemented each one that I came across in the book. I thought, well, I'll try that out. And some I found easier than others. But yeah, my first impression was just a very positive one, really.
Fascinating. Thank you. I've just found David Dardow's blog from 2018, where he talks about the writing revolution. And his final thoughts are, there's little point practicing paragraphs if the sentence hasn't been mastered. Similarly, there's small value in spending time writing essays if you don't know how to develop thoughts within a paragraph. So yeah, certainly. And what came up with Joe as well was we've had a lot of, you know, we've seen lots of people talk about how they've used it, and it's been sort of a word has spread, I suppose. I suppose the next question then is, because you've talked already about how you began to incorporate it, what's the writing revolution enabled your students to do which they couldn't do before or struggled with before?
The big change is the way, like, writers who and readers who are struggling, traditionally struggle, they might not be able to access a book like Treasure Island at all on their own, have kind of successfully incorporated the, you know, the vocabulary and things. So we traditionally, I think I taught vocabulary and then the students' reflections on a piece of work kind of two separately. And that by everything I'm doing at the moment is all linking to the text we're reading. And it's meant that they can really kind of demonstrate their understanding. Like Joe said, writing about a subject is the ultimate demonstration that you actually know what you're talking about and understand something. And there's one bit kind of really sticks in my mind. We read The Secret Garden, and this boy in my class who, you know, his English isn't great, and he was one of those struggling readers. But he managed to say, you know, Mary Lennox, the main character, Mary Lennox was a fretful child. Again, it was this because but so thing. So he said Mary Lennox was a fretful child because her parents were indifferent about her. And, mm-hmm. you know, indifferent and fretful were these words that early, I would say, you know, put them on a spelling list and then also talk about the definitions and try and put them into a sentence. But actually, because everything's linking to the text and then they've just got this building block approach, there's no way he would have got there. I think it's worth saying at the same time, though, that I think it's a slightly misleading title. I don't think it's a revolutionary approach. I just kind of think of it as a really helpful, systematic approach. A lot of these things we'd be doing before, but it just feels a lot more focused.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the writing systematic approach rolls off the tongue just as quite as easily, though.
No, it might not have been
no. But very interesting, of course, to hear about this with regard to vocabulary as well. And it's something which Joe didn't talk about, and it's something which I haven't really thought about as much as well in terms of using the target vocabulary. I suppose when I look back at what I've done with sort of year 10 in particular in my GCSE classes, I'm looking at some sort of key substantive content and concepts when we've taught Elizabethan England and some of the key things in terms of foreign policy and, you know, conflict and religion as well. And, you know, I suppose I've done it, I've sort of bumped into it, but I haven't explicitly mapped it or planned it out. So, yeah, that's really interesting. It's made me think about my own practice, which is excellent, the sort of thing we want on Teachers Talk Radio. Which strategies have you found most helpful then from the writing revolution, and why?
So in general, I'd say the biggest strategy overall is that just the focus on sentence work. But specifically, there's one that they talk about, which is the run-on sentence. And I know that primary school teachers who hear this will know what I'm talking about. When a child writes, you know, Jim Hawkins ran out of the Admiral Benbow, and then Blind Pew shouted at the pirates, and then and you get this basically a paragraph with no full stops, and it's just this enormous kind of list of words, and it's just unwieldy. And one thing in the writing revolution, one of the exercises is giving the students one that I write. So I really enjoy doing this now. I write a really horrible run-on sentence style paragraph. And I just give it to them and say, you need to fix this. And it's amazing how quickly they know how to fix that. But previously, I'd waste a lot of hours because they'd give me a run-on sentence thing and I'd be fiddling with it, saying, right, find the missing full stops and do this. But actually, flipping it round, that one was really useful. So I just give them these horrible sentences and we work on how to fix that together. That's also one that's really easy to differentiate for people who are already great writers, because what they end up doing is saying, well, I put that bit of the sentence actually up to start the paragraph with that bit. And, you know, you just slip in these things saying, can you start one of your sentences with because? Can you put although in a sentence there, or add an appositive there? And it just becomes so second nature and quick. That's been really, really useful.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's definitely not unique to primary school students. Again, I had a year 13 who just kept on writing and writing and writing without a full stop. I think the record I got was 170 words in one sentence. But I don't want to, I don't want to embarrass them too much by going on too much about it.
No, because often, you know, it's really good stuff because all the information's there, and they demonstrate they know stuff. It's just you can't express yourself that way in writing. Because it's unwieldy. But what happens is those kids who do struggle, what they're doing essentially is replacing "and then" with a full stop. And that is actually fine for them. And that's really good and a very useful skill. But other kids end up really kind of elaborating and changing the sentence structure because they think things might go better. So it's really useful as a whole class.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You kind of hinted at this already. How have you gone from the sentence level to the paragraph level with the writing revolution?
Joe said earlier, look after the words and the sentences take care of themselves, and look after the sentences, the paragraphs take care of themselves. I would say that the other thing that's definitely, and that's very nice and correct, the other thing that is in the writing revolution is kind of going the other way as well. And saying, you know, here's a paragraph. What would the single paragraph outline look like? And that's quite useful as well. I think the paragraph level is something it's nearly as important, really, because what we've ended up doing is having such detailed plans before we start writing. Before, what I'd have is something a bit more kind of nebulous and less direct. So rather than, you know, there's a topic sentence and supporting details, what order will they go in? Where will you add this word? Where will you add this word? And it's always a bit of a tightrope. Again, I'm sure nothing is specific to primary school, but in primary school, you definitely have this tightrope of like, well, how much scaffolding do you give them? You know, scaffolding needs to be taken away at some point. When do you take it away? If you give loads and loads of scaffolding, what you end up with is loads of people producing really amazing writing, but often the really amazing writing looks very similar to each other. But I found the more effort we're putting into our own planning, actually the more variety I get in the class, and the overall quality is a bit better anyway. So we end up with these SPOs, these single paragraph outlines, and a multi-paragraph outline, thinking about how the whole thing sits together. Whereas before, I might do more focus on, you know, right, how do we make this hang together? Well, we start a paragraph with this kind of sentence that links it to the paragraph before it. But I feel like that's overstepping because we haven't quite got the plan right yet. But yeah, all the SPO and MPO, like my kids all know those acronyms now. We have to know loads, so they should have to know some as well. So.
Great. I suppose this next question, which I'm going to ask about responding to Jim Carroll and Christine Council, is slightly different from a primary perspective. But, you know, you teach multiple subjects. It's not just English. It's not just literacy. Yeah. I was wondering whether or not you had used the writing revolution in different subjects and maybe adapted it slightly. And the argument from Jim Carroll and Christine Council that actually the writing revolution doesn't help to improve writing within particular subject domains. I was wondering, as you know, from a primary perspective, whether you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, if I'm perfectly honest, when I knew that you were going to ask that question, and I had to look up a bit of what they'd said about it, and this might well be more of a secondary school concern, which is not because of huge gaps in ability, but just because, you know, I am there. English, history, geography, science, RE teacher. So I imagine my approach is slightly blurred. You know, I'm not exactly thinking, right, how do I write like a geographer as much as you might as a geography teacher? But I think, I mean, I feel, and I'm sure I might be wrong, but as a history teacher, if you're teaching, you know, the Tudor rebellions, you might well have, you know, these strong models of how to write historically. So Jim Carroll, is it Jim Carroll? Yeah, mm-hmm. He's saying, you know, it doesn't teach you how to write historically. But then if you have a very strong model of what historical writing looks like, I'm sure that the exercises within the writing revolution could be adapted to kind of suit them. So even even if the examples that are in the book might not be very good for your domain, I feel like it's kind of, it could be adapted, but I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I think it's that's a good response, I think. And certainly there are parts of the writing revolution where I think, well, this is applicable to almost all subjects. Mm. And there are parts of it where I think, well, actually, maybe not. As well as teaching history, of course, I teach music. And okay. So, you know, I think about the writing revolution in terms of music, and I think, well, actually, I probably could use because buttons, say, within music, but maybe not in terms of writing, but maybe orally. So, for example, you know, I've got a high-pitched part here because I want it to evoke whatever it is. I've got a high pitch here, but I've lowered the pitch here. Exactly. So I think there are elements where where a multidisciplinary approach works. I suppose from a primary perspective, where some of the lines are blurred, because you have to be, you know, because you have to teach so many different subjects. Mm. I suppose, you know, there are implications there, but I mean, no secondary school teacher I've ever come across envies primary school teachers when it comes to teaching so many subjects. So we do have to cut you a bit of slack there.
It's also just the bits of the curriculum you're responsible for planning, because I'm very much an English bod at the moment. So I'm thinking now, you know, the reason I'm looking into these things a lot is because our school is probably going to be moving away from a particular literacy program that we follow. Mm. And I'm going to be responsible for a lot of how we implement something new. So it's not just the writing revolution, but there's like Reading Reconsidered, the Doug Lamov thing. That's been really helpful. And actually, when I read the writing revolution, it was like the last piece of the puzzle, kind of. So when you talk about substantive knowledge, it's like, what is substantive knowledge in literature? Well, it's kind of, it's all the vocabulary we need to use, but it's also like what we know about the world of that book. So when we did The Secret Garden, I could talk to them about Francis Hodgson's Burnett's like crazy Christian Science beliefs about how, you know, all illness is an illusion and all that stuff. And it really deepened their reading of it, and talking about embedded nonfiction and that stuff. And just, I think the basis of all that sentence level stuff, as long as everything you're doing is linking to that, I think Joe said something similar, as long as it's linking to that primary text, it just becomes really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Really good thoughts there. And my final question is, what would your advice be to any teacher thinking of using writing revolution strategies in their classroom?
Well, I must say I don't feel qualified necessarily.
Oh, no, you are. You are.
But I will anyway. You know, because I only read the book a few months ago and I haven't been a teacher that long. But anyway, I suppose my general advice would be not to, despite the catchy title, not to see it as something that will completely revolutionize, you know, what you're doing, but just see it as a really useful toolkit with really good ideas. But in September, I'm going to have a trainee, and I've already given it to him because he's volunteering at the moment and coming in. I said, read this book, because in September, I'm going to be using it a lot. You're going to be watching me do it. And like you said, with, you know, I think you had a trainee.
Yeah.
Too. Just working with him on that. And I think when I was training, I would have really loved to have had that book. Because actually, even though all my academic history is in history and English, but that was the reason I think I found it hard to teach, because I trained in year two. And it was like, how do I break down what I know? And there also earlier, there's that thing as well about, you know, they're arriving in year seven. You know, and they don't know how to write a sentence. But I imagine you hear as well, like, they're arriving in year 10. And
we
hear it in school. You know, I get it. I've probably said it. You know, they're arriving in year 5 and they don't know how. But I think people forget things, first of all. But also it is just going back to the first thing Joe said, is just that assumption of knowledge and assumption of how to write a paragraph and a sentence. So don't assume what people, what pupils can do, and then just think of the book as something, a useful little guide, I think.
Maybe we should call it the writing evolution.
Think of it as an evolutionary
approach, I think, and sort of building it in little by little, gradual approach, and just, you know, help cumulatively to improve students' writing.
Yeah.
I think if we end that on there, then hey, job done. Thanks so much for coming on, George.
All right, thanks for having
not
me.
Long now until the end of term.
No.
Enjoy your last few days before your holidays.
Yeah, you too.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye. We're now going to take a short ad break and go back to Jay Fox for our weekend news. Stay tuned, because after a break, we'll be talking about a pertinent topic as we approach the summer holidays. Why do teachers move schools, and why do they stay put, even when they know the school is not the right place for them?
Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
According to reports in the Manchester Evening News, hundreds of students attending high schools across Bolton are set to take part in catch-up sessions over the summer break. Many schools across the borough have taken up the Department for Education's offer of funding for summer schools following disruption due to the pandemic. Following advice from government, many of the schools are focusing on Year 7, as many primary schools have been unable to manage the usual transition process. It is expected that the majority of the sessions will be devoted to students due to start high school in September and will focus on building relationships with staff and getting to know the buildings and facilities. 21 schools across Bolton are holding summer schools, which equates to 73% of all eligible mainstream secondaries in the area. The funding comes from a £200 million pot, which was announced in February by the Department for Education. Primary school has won a landmark case in the High Court. Yew Tree Primary School in Sandwell has succeeded in preventing the Department for Education forcing it to become an academy after Ofsted graded it inadequate. In a judgment on Friday the 23rd of July, Gavin Mansfield QC said he had grave concern about the decision to transform it into an academy. As reported by ITV News Online, the judge said there was clear evidence of both continued efforts to improve and success in achieving those improvements. The judge therefore concluded that the decision to force academisation was irrational. The court's decision does not overturn the academy order, but it does force the Education Secretary to consider the decision again and to take additional evidence into account. In January 2019, an academy order was issued following the inadequate judgment, but when a subsequent inspection took place 9 months later, the school was removed from the category of serious weakness. A Department for Education spokesman said it was now considering its next steps in relation to Yew Tree Primary. The BBC News website reports that English language schools are facing a second summer of empty classrooms due to the pandemic. Most schools receive pupils from all over the world during the summer, but English UK, who represent a sector worth around £1.4 billion a year, is on the verge of collapse. Language schools feel their plight has been overlooked during the pandemic. The Anglo-Lang School in Scarborough would normally welcome around 2,500 students each year, but for the last two summers, classrooms have been deserted. A group of 36 MPs have written to the A group of 36 MPs have written to Boris Johnson calling for support for the language teaching sector as the pandemic puts 35,000 jobs at risk and the loss of the $1.4 billion brought to local economies as students study, live and entertain themselves in local areas.
Welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio. It is 2:04 p.m. and you are listening to the Saturday Lunch with me, Tom Hopkins Burke. A very warm welcome to our listeners in the live studio at the moment. I can see that you are regular listeners of the show, but I can't see what your names are because they start with PBG and then they have a lot of numbers and letters after them. So if you do want to go to your profile on Podbean and edit your name so I can see who you are and where you're calling from, then that would be absolutely wonderful. Moving on then, I want to ask why teachers move schools and why they stay put even if they are not happy. It's a different question to why do teachers leave the profession. I'm asking why teachers stay in the profession but move schools, not why they leave the profession. Christopher's added The Reading Revolution to my summer reading list. I'm not sure if that's a new book. I think it's The Writing Revolution, Christopher. One of my GCSE students has attended 11 schools in his 15 years on the planet. One of my GCSE students has attended 11 schools in his 15 years on this planet. It's unsettling, it's difficult, it's unnerving. These changes are difficult for teachers too. Now, I don't know whether there's been a teacher in this world who's had 11 permanent contracts at 11 different schools for the last 15 years. That would be verging on the ridiculous, I think. But teachers do move schools, and some schools have greater turnover than others. The question I want to consider today is why teachers move schools and why they stay put even if they're not happy. The history teacher in me looks at this through a variety of lenses in terms of why teachers move schools. There are the long-term background factors. The slowly increasing workload, the constant drip of criticism, the bullying from senior members of staff. Then there are the medium-term factors, the catalysts, if you like, the short and medium-term factors. They're not the sparks, but like the fire. No, I'm going to come on to those later. But they're the factors which speed up the decision to leave. It might be a poor lesson observation. It might be a change in management at middle or senior leadership level that makes you uncomfortable. It might be a lack of prospect of promotion in your current setting. And then there are those trigger factors. Maybe the dream job comes up. Maybe you've been told you need to find another job because of restructuring, or you might need to move to a different part of the country, or a different country altogether because of personal family circumstances. First things first, I'm going to go for a reason I can think of as to why teachers don't move schools. Now, I'm fortunate because I'm coming to my end of my second year as a qualified teacher, and I am staying put, and I'm more than happy to be staying put. I've had the opportunity to work on curriculum development in parts of our Key Stage 3 curriculum. I've had the opportunity to plan a Key Stage 5 history unit from scratch, and I'm currently working on creating our politics course from September. I am content, I'm happy, I feel suitably challenged. I know senior leaders will have my back. I have a supportive line manager who puts up with me most of the time. I'm part of a harmonious faculty where even free tags and the looming spectre of the inevitable Ofsted inspection next year, we've pulled through as one. I'm ambitious only in the sense, really, that I want to be the best history teacher I can possibly be. I'm very early on in my career. I'm not actively looking for promotions. I just want to be happy, to be challenged and to be supported. At the moment I have that, why would I leave? But some teachers don't have that challenge, that support, that happiness in their job. Even so, they can sometimes be afraid of moving on. Rob Archer, a career psychologist, calls this career paralysis. He's explored five common psychological reasons why teachers are afraid to move on, to switch schools. I'm going to go through what Mr. Archer says on that. The first reason he gives of the five is the paradox of choice. Archer says that when teachers think about other places they can go, or indeed other careers, the choice can be mind-boggling. We also start to think about what might have been and regret those decisions. It's a double-edged sword. We find it hard to make a decision, and then we regret the decisions we do and don't take. Now, in 2000, psychologist Sheena Iyengar and Mark Lepper investigated the limits of choice. They found when choosing between jams or chocolates, shoppers were more likely to make a selection when given 6 choices compared to 24 or 30 choices. Barry Schwartz popularized the idea that each additional choice can actually subtract from satisfaction. Schwartz argued an overabundance of choice creates anxiety and excessively high expectations. If these expectations are not met, regret and self-blame follow. In its most extreme form, excessive choice can lead to decision paralysis, where a fear of regret makes it so that one would rather not do anything than to commit to something they are unsure of. Imagine you're a teacher, a subject teacher, and you go on to test jobs and you search for teaching jobs in your subject at a 30-mile radius, and you see a position in one school that looks promising, and you think, oh, I'll go for that, and then you find another one, and another, and another, and yet another, and more still. What Schwartz is arguing there is with each additional choice, you're less likely to make a decision and take a plunge. Be very interested to hear whether that's something you have personally experienced. Rob Archer's second reason for career paralysis is the idea of negative bias. This is the idea that we instinctively pay more attention to negative things over the positive. Faced with a choice between a safe old thing and a scary new thing, we're more likely to choose the former and to exercise caution. Again, is that something you have experienced when thinking about moving on? The third reason Rob Archer gives is the fact that staying put is the easy option. Short-term ease is preferable over long-term gain. Moving on is scary. There's the uncertainty of the future and a fear of failure. We want to head towards our future goals, but this direction is scary. We can pull away from this discomfort and back towards the familiar, even if you're not completely happy with it, because it's much easier to stay put than move on. Archer's fourth reason is functional fixedness, the sense that we can only do what we've always done. And Michael Tidd wrote along these lines in TES in October 2019. I'm going to read what he says about this because it's absolutely fascinating and it may well chime with you. Everything is harder when you start at a new school. You suddenly realise how much you knew about the old place and how much you have to learn about the new. Even though timetables in all schools are very similar, it's the subtle differences that make change all the harder. Remembering whether assembly is at 10:25 or 10:35 is a complication you've not had to worry about before, and getting used to a school day finishing at 3:10 instead of 3:15 can set your lessons all out of kilter. Then there's a new photocopier to work, a different kitchen to navigate at coffee time, even the etiquette of whether you need to contribute to the tea fund or which tea bags are part of a communal kitty. And that's before you even begin to mention the actual teaching. The biggest shock can be the loss of reputation. Often after a few years in one school, your reputation can do some of the legwork for you. New classes have heard rumour of what your expectations are, and a few words spoken to errant pupils at break time can quickly become your first impression for some pupils. No such luck in a completely new school. Instead, every group must test you out to see where your boundaries lie. You don't even have the arsenal of pupil names at your fingertips that once was the case. You can certainly learn those in your own class within the first few days, but the other hundreds of children across the school will remain a mystery for some time. It makes managing those minor corridor infractions and playground misdemeanors so much harder. You can't even share the stories of your disasters in quite the same way you once did. Your colleagues may well all seem nice enough, but it takes time to work out who your closest and trusted workmates will be. And so for a while, it makes the old colleagues all the more missed. But rest assured, if this is you this year, that the time will come when those initial struggles will be a distant memory and this new school will likely feel just as loved as your old. In fact, when I left that second school and moved on again, I think there might have been a tear in my eye once more. Michael Tidd made it the move, but his story explains why so many didn't. Rigid ways of thinking can hold us back. The fear of the new, of the unknown, and of leaving what we know behind. Again, this is functional fixedness, the sense that we can only do what we've always done. The final reason Archer keeps is because of cognitive fusion. This is the idea that our mind treats thoughts as facts. If your mind tells you you're not good enough and that you won't succeed, you're hardly likely to try to move on. These mental barriers that Archer identifies definitely stop teachers from trying to find a new school, trying to move on. It's that old saying that the grass isn't always greener on the other side. I look at the good things that I have in my current school. Lots of sick form teaching, a strong behaviour system, terrific colleagues. You even heard three of them on my previous shows. I don't know that any new school might struggle to provide all three. However, having said this and having gone through the reasons why teachers stay put even when they're not happy, it's important to note that according to the life insurance firm Liverpool Victoria, the average worker changes employer every 5 years. So teachers do overcome these mental barriers and they do make the decision to move on. I want to think about how exactly they do that. So when do teachers know it's the right time to move schools? The first thing to consider, I suppose, is stress. Stress makes you tired, it makes you ill, it makes you stay awake at night. Day after day of unproductive work or terrible management or conflict with students just makes you stressed. When school-based stress consumes your life, you know it's time to move on. When you go home, the only thing you can talk about or want to talk about is how your day's been horrible. You know it's time to move on. When you're on holiday and yet you're still plagued by work-related anxiety, you know it's time to move on. The weight off your shoulders when you leave a toxic workplace behind is indescribable. The lifting of that stress is liberating. So one reason why teachers know it's the right time to move on is because they might feel stressed in their current workplace through factors unique to that workplace. Teaching is a stressful job at times, but there are ways in which schools and leaders can make it less stressful. So stress is my number one reason. Another reason why teachers might move schools is because of their interactions at their current place of work. With students, with their peers, with management. If you are surrounded by a cloud of negativity when it comes to your interactions, much like with a stress point, it can feel all-consuming. If a bar is always set just too high for you to achieve, if your pupil progress is just never good enough, if your students make negative remarks, it's time to move on. If your staff room interactions consist solely of your colleagues complaining about whatever it may be, that's not a place you want to work, where negativity pours out of your colleagues. So negative interactions would be my second reason. Another reason, the third reason why teachers might move schools, in my view, is because of the extent of support from management, or perhaps the lack of it. I've usually felt supported by my management, but sometimes as a teacher you can live your life under siege. There can be golden years, but there can also be gilded years where you're caged in. Without a solid professional support system, teaching would be unbearable. If students and parents complain that their grades aren't as high as they should be, and your management sides with a parent over you, you know it's time to move on. If a parent yells at you in a face-to-face parents' evening, God, how I don't miss those, does a member of SLT jump into the fuse situation? It happened to me once, 7 p.m, the final appointment of the evening, and my deputy had jumped in and stuck by me. I'll always remember that. Yes, it is their job, but it makes a world of difference if they help you, if they support you. If you don't get that support, it's time to move on. My fourth and final reason for today is because maybe in that school you can't climb any further. I hinted at this when I talked about my own experiences. I am ambitious, but insofar as I want to be the best history teacher I can possibly be. My PGCE tutor at York, Helen Snelson, had an oft-repeated phrase but will always stick by me. It takes 5 years to become a teacher, or takes 5 years to make a teacher. By this, I think Helen meant, don't jump into management or leadership positions or TLRs too quickly when you are yet to refine your own teaching craft. I would be keen to hear from you as to whether you agree with Helen on that. But when you feel as if the time is right to move up, do you have that opportunity? Does it look as if those in leadership or middle management are there to stay? Does an opportunity arise? Will an opportunity arise? In this situation, it doesn't really matter how stressful your school day is, how positive or negative your interactions are with others, or how supported you feel. If you feel as if your career is stagnating, even in a wonderful school, and you want to move up and your school can't provide you with that, then it's time to move on. It may well be worth speaking to your head teacher if you're in a supportive school and talking about this conundrum. If you plant that seed with leadership that you're looking to move on for a promotion and your head teacher is keen to keep you at the school, they might start to consider what opportunities are available for you. But in a school which isn't supportive, it may just be wise to get out first. So those are my four main reasons why teachers move schools. What have I missed? If you're listening live, text in and call in with your thoughts. If you're listening back, then tweet me at HB_history or tweet us at TTRadio2021 with your thoughts. Do you agree with me? Do you disagree? What have I omitted? I want to hear directly from you. We're running 4 minutes ahead of schedule, so the Teachers Talk Radio Twitter account tweeted out, why do teachers stay put in schools when they know they aren't happy there? I wonder who could have been responsible for that tweet, eh? And we've had loads of responses, so I'm going to read for a few of these before we end today. Nick Wood says, moving schools to where? Options that don't involve expensive or emotionally exhausting uprooting family type events aren't always easy to come by. Do we really know if the grass is greener elsewhere? Freya Adele, who is back on Teachers Talk Radio now, she says there's a loss of confidence to apply elsewhere. Zoe Enters agrees, but sadly a lot of that. They've been made to believe they aren't good enough for this school, so why would anyone else want them? Plus they're too drained to apply. Christina Johns says, is this rhetorical? If not, so many reasons. They might be part-time and love the hours, but commute. Planning a family like the head of department, don't have to teach other subjects, and that's a fear they can't be bothered applying. Fear, better the devil you know. Better the devil you know came up a lot in these tweets. Becky says, I live in a city everyone wants to live in. Not many jobs come up. Most go to younger people when they do. Math, science and English colleagues move around more easily. Martin Billingham tweeted, stereotypical answer is, for the kids, they need me, which may be true, but it's also true that there'll always be other students in other schools who need you. Don't be a martyr. Be as good to yourself as you are to others. Easier said than done. Laura H. says, there's a feeling that the grass may not be greener. There's a lack of confidence, or the application and interview process is super draining. Maybe on a future show I'm going to talk about how we can streamline the application process for schools. Maybe have a common application form, because it's a lot of work, especially for trainee teachers who are applying for several jobs at once. Miss Houston says, I'm not sure of others' experiences, but over my 20-year career, I've had very little choice. I've been placed in schools based on local authority availability. I think she teaches in Scotland. I've applied for jobs, been successful, but only once in a school I wanted, and it was a short-term contract. English teacher, at English teacher, with a lot of double E's, says the grass is browner. Some, the worry is that wherever they go, it would be worse, which is foolish, but I know some better, the devil you know types. Dr. Mark Anderson says, a school can knock your self-esteem and gaslight you. into feeling you won't get another job and may give you a bad reference. Also, for part-time teachers, each year can be a precarious, draining struggle of timetabling negotiation, leaving them fearing inflexibility elsewhere. Claire Jemima Yaxley has tweeted, "Horrible job interview process, but risk it's worth somewhere else." Abandoning their classes for desperate hope that things will get better. But what if it just doesn't? David Bullio says, "The devil you know may be better than the devil you don't know. It's a great question. Pursuing a new job is a huge task. And for some, there are family considerations to consider as well." Mrs. M says, "It's very difficult to move on if you're deemed too expensive." Good point. I'm main scale. I'm cheap. What if you're on UPS? Finding another job and making a sideways move is very difficult at the moment. Lila Al-Rashed says, "Too much experience under your belt. It's difficult to get a job elsewhere as a teacher without TLR because you're too expensive." Loads of points about this in the tweets about expense as well. In Northern Ireland, Scotty McFarlane says, "It's likely due to a lack of other opportunities. Permanent jobs here are like hen's teeth." I must admit, I don't quite understand how it works in Scotland and Northern Ireland. I think in Scotland, you go through the local authority, but anybody with any knowledge about Scotland and Northern Ireland and how you go about applying for jobs, do text in. Miss Ali says, "They get used to it, that is the toxicity, and start thinking it may be normal." Yes, has that happened to you? Be very interested to hear. This question is, why do teachers stay put, even though they know the school is not the right place for them? Victoria Dick says, "Frying pans and fires spring to mind." Student SOS, "Who's to say the next job will be better?" Kate Victoria says, "Money, commitments, family or domestic, fear of frying pans, fire. Confidence shattered, so feel unable to write a positive application." The UK Ambassador for Happiness Action, Jackson, says, "Fear of rejection and comfort. This is the same for many of us in life. We'd rather justify staying in the current negative circumstance than face the journey to a positive and happy future." And finally, Daniel echoes what I said earlier on this afternoon. "The thought of starting again and having to build your reputation." You have a reputation in your current school. You don't if you go elsewhere. So building that up from scratch takes a long time. We are now approaching the end of today's Saturday Lunch show. A massive, massive thank you to Joe Kinnaird and to George Knapfein for coming on to talk about improving students' writing. And thank you for listening to me talk about why teachers move on and why they stay put, even if they aren't happy. So a big round of applause, please, to Joe and George. As ever, I'm going to plug the shows which are on in the next few days. Tomorrow, we have Sobia Iqbal at 9 a.m, who's hosting a panel debate on social mobility. It promises to be a fascinating discussion. It's her last show until the 15th of August, so make sure you don't miss it. Graham Collum and Khalil Rouse are back. And then at 8 p.m, it's the return of Dr. Herine Otieno, who's talking about teachers' mental health in Africa, a really important topic. Next week, we move to our summer schedule. The vast majority of our hosts are still live, even if they're missing the odd show, because like you, we need our holidays. However, some of the timings are changing to account for the fact that unless you teach in Nottinghamshire, of course, most teachers will be on their summer holidays. So on Monday, Mal Krishnasamy is back and live at 9 a.m. rather than at 7 a.m. And that will be the rule for the breakfast shows until September, live at 9 till half 10 for your breakfast show hosts. And that means the morning break, which you're used to starting at 9 a.m. with the likes of Tom Rogers, will now be between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m. Our drive home shows, our twilight shows, late shows and late shows are still on at their usual times, taking you through from 4 p.m. all the way to 11:30 p.m. And your favourite hosts are still taking your calls and texts. On a weekend, after tomorrow, so the week after, the Dr. Herine Otieno will be at 3 p.m. on the new afternoon show. That's another change in the summer schedule. If you're looking for something new to do during your summer holidays, why not take the plunge and apply to host your own show on Teachers Talk Radio? The summer holidays are the perfect opportunity to have a two-show trial and decide whether or not it's for you. If you've been a listener of my show or any other Teachers Talk radio show and you'd like to try hosting a show yourself, why not DM us at TTRadio2021 on Twitter? Fill out the contact form on our website, ttradio.org/contact. Or send us an email at teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we are keen to promote as wide a range of voices as possible. So don't worry if you think your style is different to some of the shows you've listened to so far. You have the chance to create your own style. That is it from me today. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and your summer holidays if you don't teach in Nottinghamshire. 3 more days to go. For me, see you next week for the next Saturday lunch, by which time I will be firmly on my summer holidays. Tune in, talk it out.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.